and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, 1 year has passed since 26-year-old Breonna Taylor was killed in her own home by Louisville, Kentucky police in a no-knock raid. She was an emergency medical technician who had no police record. On the anniversary of her brutal slaying, protesters have taken to the streets in several U.S. cities calling for justice. So far, none of the officers involved in her killing have been charged with the crime. Will this be just another dead black person where people call for justice but are unlikely to get it? I'd like to turn to Washington, D.C. and talk to Colin Campbell. Colin, good to have you with us. Well, tell us about what has taken place during this 1 year and also, of course, on the anniversary.
That's right. And we look at how much progress has been made since Breonna Taylor's death. And as we can tell, not much has been done. These people who are protesting are outraged over the constant ignorance and neglect of trying to find justice for Breonna Taylor, as there have not been any substantive arrests made in her death. We do know that there have been some money and a wrongful death lawsuit and things like that. But as far as really punitively punishing the people who are responsible for her death, the state has come very far short. Not to mention, we found out soon after the verdict came out that the attorney general really did not provide the right amount of evidence or withheld certain pieces of evidence from being submitted that would render a verdict where Breonna Taylor would not get ultimate justice for being killed while being innocently in her home. And I think that's why you're seeing so many people who are frustrated and just angry and outraged at all of this, is because it could happen to any one of them. It could happen to any one of us, where you could be in your home doing something that you do normally every day, grabbing a pot of coffee, talking on the phone with a friend or a loved one, watching television, and you could be shot dead, and the person responsible for that could still walk around freely without any type of compassion or any type of punitive measure being served or any type of justice being rendered to the victim. And again, we are seeing these protests in Kentucky. We are seeing them in other parts of the United States as they look at other grievances that have come at the hands of police.
Thanks so much for that update, Colin Campbell out of Washington, D.C. Staying in D.C., I'd like to welcome Matthew Fogg, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshals Service. Matthew, thanks so much for being with us. Why does this just seem to repeat and repeat itself again? In your perspective, why haven't we seen any officer charged so far in the death of Breonna?
Well, thank you for having me on. And I think one of the problems is that the historical issues we have in this country with law enforcement, and especially people of color. We know that it's been disproportionately applied. We know that across the criminal justice system all the way. And the problem is in law enforcement, stuff having been in it for 30 years. Officers can make mistakes. I got that. I understand that. But when you see it happening over and over again for the same happening when it's a race issue, it becomes a race issue, which racism is systemic in America now, and the president, everybody has admitted to it. The problem is, how do you hold people accountable? And you've got systems and institutions in place. These officers got a no-knock warrant. They went and knocked on, went to Breonna Taylor's location and ended up mistakenly, whatever you want to call it, but the bottom line is she wound up dying in that process, and nobody was ever held accountable. And what we're seeing over and over again, and I saw it in my own self in law enforcement, it's very difficult to have the whole white officers actually be accountable for killing black citizens. And there were always some, yeah, money is paid out, but there's no accountability. So, and as long as the system remains in its place, you will continue to have these type of incidents. And until the government and everybody comes together and says, listen, this is a race matter. We got to deal with it as a race matter. And people have to be held accountable if they do the wrong things. And I feel when you do the wrong thing, somebody can get killed. So the bottom line is you got to start holding people accountable. And it seems like this system still is not ready to really hold culprits accountable for the things that when we do things wrong in law enforcement. Again, it's a race issue. It's going down party lines, race issues, when it seems to be an issue against black Americans, black and brown Americans.
Okay, stay with me, Matthew. Let me welcome my next guest, Yane Ndego, a writer, singer, and activist out of Philadelphia. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, you heard, hopefully, what Matthew was saying, that it is very difficult to see white officers being charged in the killing of Black Americans. We know that the opposite, listening to interviewers before, of Black police officers who are very careful, especially if before they want to fire at a white individual. But the other side of the coin is not the same. What is it going to take to change that status quo?
Well, I think we have to examine this from the core and from the root of where this comes from. And racism is definitely a key component, but racism is actually a tool of imperialism, of capitalism, of patriarchy. And those are the things that are really driving this. And the reason that the status quo is not being changed is because it supports the elite in the U.S. and those people who are in the ruling class who actually benefit from the discrepancies in the ways that the legal system is applied depending on the parties that are involved. And so while police officers may make mistakes, the police as a larger overarching organization and agency, it's spoken as if it is here for to serve and protect all members of the community, but their really primary purpose is to protect the property owners, the people who have the most wealth. And so all of the issues of the dynamics around race actually support the stopping people from fighting against the class and capitalist issues that are in place in the U.S. because people will allow things to happen that that are inappropriate or that are wrong because it is because of their racism. And they will support things that are happening that are inappropriate because of their racism. And even if the system that is in place is not one that supports the best interest of most people in the country, and most working class people don't benefit from the current system that's in place. So we need to look deeper than even just the race concern. Race is significant, but we have to recognize it as a tool of the larger oppressive system that is used to keep working class and poor people disempowered and prevent them from working together.
Well, let me stay with you, Yane, because let me stay with you, staying with what you just talked about as far as it being a class issue and it being a tool of imperialism. With that being the case, then, why don't we see, for example, there obviously poor white individuals who are struggling, but in general, we see this continuously targeting Black people, and actually sometimes it could be Black people who are wealthy or middle class. So tell me, how does that fit into what you're saying?
Well, because as I said, racism, I'm not suggesting that racism does not exist. Racism is embedded in our society in the United States. However, racism is intentionally embedded because it is a tool that is of the capitalist class. And so what ends up happening is that because there are individuals or groups of individuals, they serve almost as buffers against the ruling class. And so that is what the larger white community serves. That's how the larger white community serves. Its role is to actually keep the issues and the concerns of other communities. So it's kind of like a divide and conquer tactic. So you have like working class white peoples, their material interests are much more aligned with those of working class Black people and working class brown people, but they fight against those individuals because of their association with whiteness, even though they don't actually gain a lot of the benefits of whiteness aside from certain much more superficial privileges. I mean, and substantial privileges like not having to be murdered by police, but by having the ability to feel that you can count on police and trust police and feel safe with police, it helps you to diminish looking at the realities that other communities are experiencing and work in collaboration with them to address the oppressive conditions that all working class and poor people face.
Okay, well, Matthew, in 2020, after George Floyd's murder, people across the U.S. took to the streets and saying Black Lives Matter and calling for accountability. What happened with that movement? Has anything changed?
I, I'm, I won't say necessarily that it's changed, because what I'm hearing is still Black Lives Matter. They're still continuing to gear up the protest and to try to do more things that change laws, regulations. We were just in Annapolis, Maryland, trying to get the policeman's law enforcement officer's Bill of Rights changed. But one of the things I noticed, just like I'm the class agent, we've got a class discrimination lawsuit against the U.S. Marshal Service. All of the black agents, most of them in the Marshal Service, we're all a part of a class. You've got a lot of class actions popping up all over the country in these law enforcement departments, which says internally we as the law enforcement officers recognize the racial disparities and the discrimination that's taking place within our departments. We don't want to do it anymore. We don't want to follow those patterns where you can see this, it's a pattern of discrimination and racial disparity. But when we speak out, of course, then the institution turns on us. So we are hoping now that more and more officers internally will speak out and will stop saying, no, we're not going to be serving and doing these no-knock warrants and things like this just in black communities. I've always said, if we did this stuff all over the country in the white communities where we serve drug warrants and everything else, this stuff would have stopped a long time ago. So what we have to understand is that we have to take a role, and that's where the law enforcement officers, I think, internally are beginning to step up to the plate, like I said, when we talk about these various law enforcement departments. So it is what the caller said. It is a problem that's deeply embedded, that comes from a historical position in America on policing. But we can take control of it, those as black officers. And when we start speaking out and standing up and saying, along with the community, we join in with the community, we say, we're not putting up with this anymore.
Well Matthew, staying with what you've just said, as far as black officers can bring about a change. However, I want to look at that, because if they go against the status quo, do you not think that they will be reprimanded and many times losing their jobs? I mean, we can widen this out, right, actually, and even look at, for example, the U.S. military, and many minorities play a big role in the U.S. military. And, of course, as Malcolm X said, and of course, Muhammad Ali, just sending poor people to fight other black, right, and brown and poor people around the world. So is it realistic that a change can come from within?
I think it can. I mean, let me put it this way. I've been fighting the Marshal Service for, 30 years or so throughout my whole career. I won a major lawsuit against the Justice Department. There were some changes that was made. But again, and people are talking about it, but the dialogue has to be raised. And that's where, when Black Lives Matter and with the pandemic and we had Donald Trump as president, we had things that lined up that said, this is the time. So I really think right now we're in an era. We've got a new president. We got somebody that's with a new attorney general, somebody that's speaking this language and actually admitting that systemic racism exists and law enforcement exists in all aspects of our structure system, and we have to change it. Once you get people admitting it, and then you've got people coming forward afraid, not afraid they're going to lose a job, like I lost my job. I went through everything that you could imagine when I first stood up, and now we've got critical mass where people are coming out, and law enforcement, the professionals are coming out admitting it and testifying and saying, yes, I've observed this type of racism. I see it happening. I can tell you this person, that person is carrying it out. Now you start to see the other side where people had these racist views start to back up a little bit. We got a lot of police officers, law enforcement people that are part of these right-wing groups, that sympathizers that had these jobs and were happy. And now they're feeling a little antsy because they realize now that people are watching them and everybody's on notice. So I think this is a time for change, and I think that can happen.
Well, Yanni, how can the United States make the necessary changes to ensure equality when the capitalist system itself has been established via genocide and slavery? And to really bring about a change would mean basically dismantling the system itself. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, that's really the truth, and that's one of the reasons why the system fights against change as much as it does, and the agents of the system fight against that change. I am an organizer with Black Lives Matter Philly, along with the Black Alliance for Peace, the Black Philly Radical Collective, and Begin to Freedom, and And one of the things that we say is there are no good cops in a racist system. And a lot of times people want to like try to boil down to individuals, but the individuals can't change the system. You move one person out with their good intentions. You have one person with their good intentions. You replace them with anybody else. You know, the system is the same. So even you replace a person with bad intentions with someone with good intentions, the system is the same. And so unless we dismantle the system, you know, I mean, even when it comes to the extraction from, you know, from other countries, the extraction from Africa, the entire African continent, if the U.S. and the Western forces were to stop those extractions, their entire economies would fall. And so there has to be a willingness amongst the people to imagine something completely new and different for all working class people. But the current system has poverty, it has violence, it has homelessness, it has those things embedded in them, because it's the only way that you can continue to take the resources and give and put them in the hands of a very few people and keep them there. And so once we begin to shift and shift from a completely systemic perspective and have people understanding that reality, which is the reason why I express the fact that this imperialism and capitalism are key and that racism is a tool to them. That's my perspective, that racism is a tool of these things and that it helps to keep the people divided. Once people overcome those things and begin to recognize that there is an enemy, that the enemy is actually those who are hoarding all of the resources from the people, and that these different militarized aspects of, or these militarized arms are actually human beings that are being used in order to diminish and to take the lives of and oppress the majority of people, not just in the United States, not even just black people, but around the world. We're not going to be able to see a difference. But we do have to still recognize that there is a substantial burden that is formed by the black and native people in the United States around the system. So even though there are people who are working class white people and poor white people that are actually suffering as well, because poverty, it goes across the board, there is an added burden that is borne by the people who are coming, who are of African descent, and the people who are native to the land, because they are needed to be the redirected as the enemies of the people, so that the people who do have the same common interests are fighting against each other and not challenging our true enemy in the ruling class.
Well, Matthew, now black people have been killed by figures of authorities for hundreds of years, and now in 2021, it's still happening. Now, there are more and more black activists who are looking at separatism as a way, believing that they will only get equity by establishing their own nation. Your take on that side of things?
Well, I think it's an expression, the cat's out the bag. I don't know if you can really try to set up a separate nation at this point, but you can set up a separate system that's determined that it will fight against racism and the issues that the fallout from it. Again, we're talking about Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and Eric Garner. We can go on and on and on. And in this current climate and world, and what I've seen, like I said, now what I'm seeing is if these officers are willing to come forward and law enforcement in that field, that's what we drove us to this point, willing to come forward and begin to identify the bigot cops. You know, I'm writing a book, Bigots with Badges, and identify how we can fight the racism from within, I think we can start to see change. Now, of course, we know that our Congress and the great lawmakers in this country still, there's a racial divide, even when we look at the makeup of our Congress and everything else. And we start to address these issues seriously. Black Lives Matter, marching, coming out forward. Because you've got to have protests. You've got to have people to come forward and to put this thing on the front burner. And I just believe from that perspective, we will start to see changes, even with the marijuana laws, the drug laws, the things that we as cops was used all types of methods to just throw people in jail because we want to get our numbers up. A lot of that is going to start to change, and I'm seeing it now beginning to slowly but surely happen. So I think this is the time, and I thank God for your caller who is with Black Lives Matter, because I've always supported that particular movement, knowing that the purpose of it was to bring attention to all of this stuff. And that's the only way you're going to deal with it. Things have to be put on the front burner. We got to deal with it, and we got to let America know, us as employees, and when they try to utilize us, to go against and to carry out these racist, these one-sided viewpoints, we say, no, we're not doing this anymore. We're going to stand up against it. And I think that's the viewpoint that we got to get across to America.
Well, Yanni, how do you think that the perspective that you were talking about, that basically you talked about, of course, the racial aspect of it, but in a capitalist system, it's more the haves and the have-nots, the 1% versus the 99%. So taking that in perspective, then, for example, there's a Secretary of Defense who's black, there's a Vice President who's black, but if they're supporting that same imperialist system, then color really doesn't matter. So with that being said, Yanni, do you think that more and more people are understanding the importance of the class differences, the importance of this basic war that's been declared against 99% by the 1%? And how key is that in your perspective for people to understand?
I think that there is an understanding. However, the reality of racism, the history of racism, and the differences in what people have experienced creates different interests and different levels of attachment to the current system, because people are enabled to become empowered. So you do have black people who are in positions of power, they still act as agents of white supremacy, right? And so that doesn't get transformed. You do have changes that happen, but the changes are always done in a way that still helps to maintain the status quo. A perfect example is looking at the difference between, like, we had enslavement and now we have mass incarceration. Mass incarceration is just a new way to enslave people, and a lot of the labor that, a lot of people labor in these prisons. They're basically free labor. They can be loaned out. And so what we have to do is we have to, as a people, we have to do the work internally to overcome the realities that have been programmed into us so that we can begin to stop functioning as agents of this oppressive system. And then we have to also recognize that we have to create completely new systems. We cannot just try to transform what's in place. We have to dismantle it and build something that cares for and takes care of everyone.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me, Yanni Ndogo, writer, singer, and activist out of Philadelphia, and Matthew Falk, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshals Service out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ.
Certainly will the believers have succeeded.
الَّذِينَ هُمْ فِي صَلَاتِهِمْ خَاشِعُونَ.
They who are during their prayer humbly submissive.
وَالَّذِينَ هُمْ عَنِ اللَّغْوِ مُعْرِضُونَ.
And they who turn away from ill speech.
Brothers and sisters, as you have been previously with us, we were talking about the first and second verses of this chapter, chapter Mu'minun. قَدْ أَفْلَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ الَّذِينَ هُمْ فِي صَلَاتِهِمْ خَاشِعُونَ. Successful indeed are the believers who are humble in their prayers. We understood that faith and purification are one in essence, and they are absolutely necessary for deliverance and for being successful. And being successful and actually reaching salvation is the ultimate and supreme aim of every program in Islam. And on top of the list for reaching salvation and deliverance is Salat, but with a special condition, with a special quality, which is khushu', being humble while performing Salat. We concluded that the word aflaha means to be prosperous, and we counted the cases of the successful ones throughout the verses of the Holy Quran and in our traditions. Having these two verses together, we understood that the Holy Quran does not count merely performing the ritual prayer itself as a sign of being from among the believers, and if one wants to be from among the believers, whose success is for sure, he has to consider humility in the ritual prayer. It means that the prayers are not meaningless. So when you perform the ritual prayer, as the true believers do, they give their complete attention to Allah. They try to detach themselves from others, from all beings other than the Almighty Allah, and they achieve a meeting with Him. And when they reach this level, they are so absorbed in contemplating and supplicating to the Divine Presence that every particle of their beings is actually influenced by performing Salat. They see themselves as a mere atom in the presence of the unlimited being, and they consider themselves nothing. And this is the true meaning of khushu'. This is the true meaning of being humble, to see yourself as a drop in a vast ocean. And for the believer, every moment of this prayer is a lesson of self-development, is actually a training in being truly human, and it's a means for refining the heart and soul.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
An Islamic tradition indicates that the Prophet ﷺ once saw a man playing with his beard while praying. The Prophet ﷺ said, if he was humble in his heart, limbs of his body would also be humble. And this shows the fact that humility is an inward state, but it affects one's exterior. The great spiritual leaders of Islam were so humble in their prayers that when they were in a state of prayer, they became estranged from all other than the Almighty Allah. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, there is no goodness in a heart that is not humble, and in an eye that does not shed tears out of fear of Allah, and in a deed that has no benefit. There is also another tradition that says when the Prophet ﷺ was standing to perform the prayers, he would occasionally look up to the heavens. But when this verse was revealed, الَّذِينَ هُمْ فِي صَلَاتِهِمْ خَاشِعُونَ, he began looking downwards. And from that time, he never raised his head while he was at prayer. He himself, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, has said, one who is not humble in his ritual prayer never receives its virtue. And when the Prophet was asked about humility, he said, it is humbleness and modesty at the time of ritual prayer, and that the servant of Allah focuses his whole heart upon Allah, the Almighty, the Glorious. And in this regard, it has been mentioned in Tuhaful Uqul that once Allah the Almighty said to Christ, shed tears for me from your eyes and be humble and modest in your heart. So the recommendation for being humble is not just confined to the Islamic thought. It is a general order for being from among the successful ones. But it has to be reached through the school of thought of Islam. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me. Why? And that's when faith begins.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. the World with reporters.
Refugee camp in the suburbs of New Delhi is gripped in utter panic and despair after hundreds were rounded last week and detained in Jammu region of Indian-controlled Jammu and Kashmir for possible deportation, according to police and local administration there.
We have no idea of what will happen to us. We are living here peacefully. We will survive on just one meal a day, but we urge the Indian government not to deport us because the military there will kill us. We are thankful to have got shelter in India. At least we are alive.
Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Estimates suggest some 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living across different states of India.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have been rising in India since the emergence of the Hindu nationalist government of the Bharatiya Janata Party in 2014. The ruling party calls the Rohingya people illegal immigrants and a security threat. Many vicious anti-Rohingya campaigns in the Jammu region also called for their expulsion a few years ago, leaving the community in great distress.
Fearing arrest and possible detention, many have gone into hiding, while others are in panic. Activists say it's unfair to detain or deport them, considering the situation in their country.
Already the refugees have started calling me up, and many have already sent me messages on the phone, apprehending danger to themselves and their community. We will take to both national and international campaigning to safeguard the security, dignity, and safety of the Rohingya refugees, as well as all other refugees in India.
Human Rights Watch and other rights groups have urged India to halt any deportation plan, saying conditions in Myanmar are not conducive. They say the Indian government should uphold its international law obligations and protect those in need of refuge within its borders. India has hosted refugees from many countries since decades, but adopted an aggressive approach towards Rohingya Muslims in particular. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In a rarely seen demonstration of unity, the French Solidarity Movement with Palestine showed its support for Olivia Zimmer, one of the pillars of the BDS movement. Olivia will be judged next week for her participation in BDS actions. The official accusation, anti-Semitism, an insult towards a foreign state. BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Against Israel.
There is no legal base to condemn me, and therefore I hope that the judges will remain independent from the political powers. By the way, the French state accepts boycott actions against China, Corsica, or against Russia and Iran. They accept that Brigitte Bardot boycotts Canadian products because of mistreating seals. But if we boycott Israel, they say it's discrimination.
The French government is acting against an important resolution of the European Court of Human Rights. This court decided in June last year that BDS is a legal political movement and obliged the French state to pay 100,000 euros to falsely condemned BDS activists. However, the French Justice Minister, Éric Dupond-Moretti, gave instructions to prosecutors, magistrates and judges in France to condemn appeals to boycott Israeli products. Since 2005, Olivia Zimmer is one of the main organizers of the BDS campaign in France, with remarkable actions in supermarkets. These kind of actions were considered worldwide as keystones and have been copied in many other countries. Other type of actions were held in official institutions like the French Football Federation to protest against the silence of Europe when Israel jailed, injured or killed footballers in Gaza. A third type of actions were protests when delegations to Palestine were withheld by Air France under direct Israeli pressure.
BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Campaign. It's very important for us as a Jewish organization to support Palestinian rights, to tell Israel that it must respect international law and that it can't get away with murder. It can't get away with just anything. And this fallacious accusation of anti-Semitism just doesn't hold water.
Today, Israel considers the BDS campaign as a real danger for its propaganda system. Therefore, it uses all kinds of pressure on Western states to criminalize it. But the Palestinian Solidarity Movement stands still and alert. As observers say, if the French government wanted to respect the recommendation of the European Court of Human Rights, it would simply cancel this trial against an important BDS activist. Chris Denhant, Paris.
Social Rights Commissioner Nicola Schmidt has presented plans in the European Parliament to lift 15 million people living in the 27-nation EU out of poverty by 2030. Lawmakers, though, seem less than convinced.
Let us be honest, these are not new problems. We have to renew our approach and our methods if we are to succeed. The Commission must coordinate better with the Member States on social targets.
MEPs say poverty affects more than 100 million people in the EU. Apparently, the bloc's handling of the COVID-19 crisis is making matters worse due to the economic fallout.
President von der Leyen has accumulated disaster upon disaster. Millions of vaccines never showed up as promised. The EU is responsible and a high price tag has been paid by so many citizens.
All that is required to ensure social justice is political will, it has been suggested.
Despite the fact that homelessness has increased by 70% in the last 10 years, we collectively show that if we want to, we can provide people with a home.
During the debate, lawmakers said there are too many poor quality jobs in the EU, too many pay cuts, too many people sleeping on the streets, too many words, and not enough action. According to experts, moves by EU nations to privatise essential services such as healthcare are impacting the poorest.
There is a problem behind, and in my understanding, it is very much ideological, because this idea of less state, less public investment, less public infrastructure, this is now paying off in a negative sense.
We are told, due to three key reasons, economic uncertainty remains extremely high in the 19-country eurozone.
Persistently high rate of coronavirus infection, the spread of virus mutations, and the associated extension and tightening of containment measures.
In May, EU leaders are due to hold a social summit in Portugal. They will go there knowing that previous targets to reduce social inequality in the EU were not met. Jerome Hughes, Brussels. Social Rights Commissioner Nicola Schmidt has presented plans in the European Parliament to lift 15 million people living in the 27-nation EU out of poverty by 2030. Lawmakers, though, seem less than convinced.
Let us be honest, these are not new problems. We have to renew our approach and our methods if we are to succeed. The Commission must coordinate better with the Member States on social targets.
MEPs say poverty affects more than 100 million people in the EU. Apparently, the bloc's handling of the COVID-19 crisis is making matters worse due to the economic fallout.
President von der Leyen has accumulated disaster upon disaster. Millions of vaccines never showed up as promised. The EU is responsible and a high price tag has been paid by so many citizens.
All that is required to ensure social justice is political will, it has been suggested.
Despite the fact that homelessness has increased by 70% in the last 10 years, we collectively show that if we want to, we can provide people with a home.
During the debate, lawmakers said there are too many poor quality jobs in the EU, too many pay cuts, too many people sleeping on the streets, too many words, and not enough action. According to experts, moves by EU nations to privatize essential services such as healthcare are impacting the poorest.
There is a problem behind, and in my understanding, it is very much ideological, because this idea of less state, less public investment, less public infrastructure, this is now paying off in a negative sense.
We are told, due to three key reasons, economic uncertainty remains extremely high in the 19-country eurozone.
Persistently high rate of coronavirus infection, the spread of virus mutations, and the associated extension and tightening of containment measures.
In May, EU leaders are due to hold a social summit in Portugal. They will go there knowing that previous targets to reduce social inequality in the EU were not met. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Protesters gathered in Islamabad to agitate against Western-funded NGOs. At the heart of their resentment are recently held rallies by the Western-funded NGOs on the eve of International Women's Day a few days ago. These protesters believe that the NGOs are systematically engaged in playing with established social norms and Islamic values by promoting Western brand of human rights in Pakistan. Many of the activists of the NGOs allegedly raise slogans of protecting lesbian and gay rights, something which is deeply offensive in a conservative Islamic society.
They're foreign-funded NGOs. They want to spread vulgarity in Pakistan. They want to spread the message of homosexuality in Pakistan. And in a country like Islamic Republic of Pakistan, we'll never ever allow this sort of vulgarity, inshallah. They want to tarnish the image of Pakistan, the ideology on the basis of which Pakistan got created, on the basis of which Pakistan came into being. They wanted to destroy that ideology, basically.
Islam has given full rights to women. No other religion has given the kind of rights which Islam has given to the women. But these NGOs are spreading obscenity and insulting Islam. The government must ban such NGOs.
There is a growing outrage in Pakistan since the NGOs started highlighting the sufferings of women from Western perspective. The number of incidents of violence against Pakistani women are far less than the Western countries funding NGOs in Pakistan to promote women rights.
The bigger part of the problem with the Western-funded NGOs is that they are focusing more on issues which might have hurt the values of a tiny liberal class in Pakistan. They hardly realize that Pakistan's social fabric is deeply conservative, and they feel offended over their attempts to secularize a society built on the norms of Islam. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The pro-independence majority in Catalonia's newly elected parliament has picked radical separatist Laura Borràs for speaker, paving the way for the election of a new coalition government within 2 weeks. The former cultural minister, who is an ally of exiled ex-president Carles Puigdemont, set the tone for the upcoming legislature.
The legislature that starts today must be a watershed towards achieving independence of Catalonia, as expressed by more than half of the citizens of this region.
Borràs was stripped of her immunity as member of Spain's Congress last year after she was accused of misuse of public funds when she was in charge of the Institute of Catalan Letters.
She has always denied the charges, saying that she is being investigated because she is an outspoken separatist.
Putting up a challenge to Borràs' separatists are members of the far-right Vox, who made their way into Catalan politics for the first time in the 2021 vote. They have vowed to break the seemingly united separatists. However, a majority of lawmakers agreed to erect a cordon sanitaire around the Populist Party, which won 11 seats in the February election.
Vox will be barred from holding any position of power in the Bureau of Parliament, despite being eligible for one.
The far-right party leader in Catalonia vowed to fight back.
Vamos a ser su peor pesadilla.
We'll be the worst nightmare, and we'll fight them on all fronts, in parliaments, in courts, and in society. We'll fight to regain this Catalonia they've hijacked.
The next stage for Catalan lawmakers is the election of a president for the region. Former Vice President Pere Aragonès from the Republican Left Party of Catalonia is the likely candidate. Is a firm believer in the independence of Catalonia from Spain, but unlike the Speaker of Parliament, he advocates a more moderate approach with the central government in Madrid.
With a speaker under investigation and a spectacular breakthrough for the far right, Catalonia's parliament is off to a rocky start. For now, the road ahead is clear for the pro-independence majority to form a government and get down to business. Except this time, the men at the helm in the Generalitat will be holding out an olive branch in one hand and the Estelada flag in the other. Kasai Kadri, Barcelona.
Tensions heat up between the United States and China again over the same old issues, which have always been a source of animosities between the world's two top economies. It was widely believed that the new U.S. administration would make changes to its foreign policy, but it seems it's still following in the footsteps of its predecessor. Amid their diplomatic row, China has once again urged the United States to stop interfering in Hong Kong's affairs and not to go down the wrong path even further. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said Beijing will resolutely safeguard its sovereign security and development interests. That after the U.S. condemned China over planned reforms to Hong Kong's electoral system, claiming the move is aimed at pushing back democracy in the city. A top Chinese government official has, however, defended the decision, saying the reform coupled with last year's security law would help manage the chaos in the city. Apart from Hong Kong, the world's two economic powers are at odds over other issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Despite repeated warnings, the U.S. Navy on Thursday announced the sailing of a warship through the Taiwan Strait, claiming it was a routine transit of the USS John Finn. It was the third such voyage through waters separating mainland China and Taiwan since President Joe Biden took office. Still, China has called on the U.S. to bring the bilateral relations back on the right track through objective and rational mechanism. It also called on the U.S. to stop interfering in China's internal affairs. The call followed a series of rhetoric by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who alleged that China is a challenge to the security and values of Washington and its allies. American and Chinese officials are scheduled to hold a cliffhanger meeting next week in Alaska, which will be the first diplomatic overture since Biden entered the White House. The outcome might improve or worsen the already tense relations between the two.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has denounced the policies of the United States. In his speech marking the occasion of Eid al-Mab'ath, Ayatollah Khamenei slammed Washington for building military bases in the region under the pretext of fighting terrorism and called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq and Syria. Ayatollah Khamenei said Washington is the only country that has used nuclear weapons in action, but it claims to be against weapons of mass destruction. He noted that Washington still has the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world. Iran's leader also accused Washington of turning a blind eye as its Arab allies keep bombarding civilians in Yemen. He pointed out that Washington and even the United Nations, however, raised an outcry as soon as the people of Yemen started defending themselves against the Saudi-led aggressors. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei said the United States is inverting the truth by claiming to support human rights while supporting those who violate them. Washington's double standards were also highlighted in remarks made by Iran's foreign minister. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said the new U.S. administration is still sticking to a policy of maximum pressure against Iran, but claims to favor diplomacy. Zarif also denounced Washington's move to block the release of Iranian assets frozen in South Korea. He noted that Iran needs the fund to purchase food and medicine as the country is fighting to contain the spread of the new coronavirus. Iran's foreign minister made the comments after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced Washington's opposition to unfreezing of the Iranian funds by South Korea. Blinken said the money will only be released when Iran returns to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran, however, says it will only reverse its commitment cuts once Washington removes all its unilateral sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Iranian officials argue it was the U.S. that threw the agreement into crisis by its withdrawal and must therefore be the one who returns to it first. On the surface, it looks like the new administration in the White House has chosen to adopt less hawkish policies and engage more with the world. But in reality, little has changed since Joe Biden took the helm in January. Eyes are now on the Biden administration to see whether Washington will choose to give up its bullying or keep on the same beaten track.
Spring is about to kick in, and nations that celebrate Nowruz are gearing up to ring in the Persian New Year. Gathering in Tehran is attended by representatives from all countries that mark the ancient tradition of Nowruz, including Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. They're here to exchange views on the history of the long-standing festivity and share their unique customs in celebrating the occasion.
The Nowruz festival in Tajikistan starts with a nationwide ceremony called Golgardani, where children who carry flowers go door to door and share the flowers with different families.
Every year during Nowruz, we take part in the Roses Festival, which is hosted by the city of Mazar Sharif, and people from all over the country gather there to celebrate.
During the Roses Festival in Afghanistan, we have a special performance called Molla Mahmad Jan, which is an exciting love story.
Nowruz means new day in Persian, and it marks the first day of spring in the Northern Hemisphere. To Iranians, it translates into a time to refresh the soul from all bad memories and make a fresh start in the year ahead.
In Iran, days ahead of Nowruz, all Iranians do the spring cleaning tradition. But what is more is the fact that not only do we dust off our houses, but we also purify our minds and our souls from any bad experiences. That's why Nowruz is regarded as a festival of peace, when nations come together and celebrate far from any political considerations.
Nowruz is now a recognized tradition in the world. In 2009, the United Nations proclaimed Nowruz an international event at the initiative of 12 countries that shared this event, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey. Nowruz has been celebrated by Iranians since three millennia ago. This year, mass celebrations will largely be limited in the wake of the coronavirus. But that's what Nowruz is all about. Throw away bad thoughts, and let's hope that in the Persian New Year, the virus will leave us alone. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, consulting with others. In the consultation sessions, it is common to express different views. Each person tries to defend his own ideas and to condemn those of others. There must be a strong manager present who could gather all the views and adopt the best view, or else such session would be fruitless. And sometimes we see these meetings here and there which are fruitless meetings because they are not moderated properly. Incidentally, in the first verse which was revealed on the Prophet on the issue of consultation, Allah says, as soon as you have decided, rely on Allah. So after consultation, the Prophet makes a decision, and then what happens? Allah commands him to rely on Allah now, because you have done your part, you have done your due diligence. Rely